Joining me today, author, composer, master guitarist. You know him from The Police. Mr. Andy Summers, next on The Culture Catch. Thank the guys at Samson Tech for the use of the Zoom Handy H4 palm-sized digital recorder to record today's show. Check them out at samsontech.com. Joining me today on The Culture Catch, Mr. Andy Summers. Many people don't realize that beyond The Police, he's had a very vital, inventive, and provocative career as a musician, songwriter, film score, and now writer.
Who knew? Writer, yes.
Who knew? And it's very in-depth, and it's not your standard. When I was reading the book, I thought, well, my God, you have a gift for literary prose, and it's not just, and then at 6 a.m. we entered the building.
No. Well, I mean, I think one of the challenges, I mean, people have asked me, why did you, you know, the cliche already is, why this book, why now? God, you know, it's not that I personally felt some sort of narcissistic need to document my life yet once again. I think a lot of people know who I am and what I've done and so on and so forth. It was really the creative challenge of writing a book and writing a book full of flowing prose. That's really what I wanted to do because I always felt I could do it. And I have, you know, I have other books out there, but this one's probably about 20 years later than I meant to. You know, because it actually started off as an 800-page book.
Wow.
Yeah, so
War and Peace.
Yeah, it was kind of War and Peace, but got it down to a more manageable size. But it was really the creative urge to write as much as anything else.
Right. And had you always kept a journal?
Yeah, I've had many journals over the years. You know, there are gaps in them, so it's not like completely obsessive, you know, daily writing. But I've always been a fairly extensive note taker, at least, you know. And of course, I photographed everything in The Police as well, so... I had stuff to look at, to you know, aid memoirs.
And then the process of just making it sound like it's natural, not it's an affected voice. I think that's really always the difficult aspect for any writer tackling his own material, is make it sound like it's really your voice, even though you may, you know, you're embellishing details to an extent. But well, you know, Frank McCourt comes to mind.
Yes, absolutely. You know, because. The thing about writing, of course, is that the voice and the style is so important because you can write about the most banal thing. It's the way you do it. It is only the way you do it. It's nice to have content, but style is everything. That's what gets it across.
So I suspect, and I'm just wondering out loud, that when you pitched the book initially, the editor you approached or the publishing house must have been pretty blown away that you had a book that was, you know, rather thought out and presentable with, obviously, other than cutting the form down, cutting the length.
Well, in fact, I didn't pitch it to anybody. I wrote the book. I wrote and finished it. I suppose somebody said, oh, you should just write 20 pages and give it in. It's not who I am. You know, you see, it's like making records. Well, give us a track and we'll think of it. I'm an artist. Yeah. I'm going to do this, and this is the way it's going to be, and I'm going to complete it for myself. When I think it's right, and finished, I'll hand it over,
right.
Which is what I did. You know, and I eventually went out somewhere first or second month of 2005 to, you know, actually sell this thing. You know, and it ended up at St. Martin's. And then, of course, there was a bit of work to do with the editor, which is normally very normal and was very helpful, actually.
Right. The thing that's most fascinating is the company you kept early on. I mean, even from an early day as a teenager, and the people that migrated in and out of your sphere of reality, some very heavy names in the music industry. And, you know, you drop them without being gratuitous at all. It's just like, you know, you get kicked out of this bar mitzvah band, basically, and Robert Fripp replaces you, which is that's a great story.
Yeah, no, pretty incredible. Well, it was the time I was born into. That was my generation. And, of course, all these people who become legends, they were just other guitarists, you know, most of the time, and people that I was in bands with. So we didn't know then what we know now.
Right, right. And plus, you were in the Renaissance period of rock and roll. I mean, it's never, ever been duplicated. Probably never will be again.
Yeah.
So, you know, to the man or born, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I started out in the 60s, but I have to say, I'm very happy that that was the generation I was born into. Because, not to sound like ancient, but I don't know if it's ever been as good. I mean, you know, you see retread after retread. But that was when, literally, it was all new. It was like rock and roll was being sort of made up. You know, the Beatles came, so-and-so, Elvis. It was an amazing time to be starting out and learning the guitar. There was very little information about guitar playing or anything then, and everybody sort of making this up. That was really the birth of it all, that 60s decade, the counterculture. I mean, there are precedents, of course, but compared to the times we're living in now, it was new then.
Right, exactly.
It was. I'm sorry, but that's the way it was, yeah.
Is there any one story that, when you were tackling the book, really just, you know, gave you a smirk? Anything?
Well, or, I mean, I think...
I'm sure there are many, but...
Yeah, I cut out many, many other very funny anecdotes. I couldn't, you know, put it all in. In the end, I had to let go of stuff that I'd been laughing about. But, what was I laughing about? Well, probably lots of it.
I like the Clapton story, where you're one of the first guys on the scene who buys an American Les Paul.
Right.
And, you know, you're migrating from the 335, which is such a great instrument anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'd already had a 335, then I later returned to it. Then I was at this point where I also had now had a Telecaster, which God knows where that one went. That was probably a 1957 Telecaster.
Oh, God. Can you imagine? You know?
Then I went and bought this... 1958 or 59 Les Paul for very little money up the road, and there was another one in the window, but I didn't think I could afford to. Eric asked me, "Man, where did you get that?" And I said, "Oh, there's another one up there. Go and get it, you know, because if I'd had a brain, you know, I would have gone and gotten the other one, and I could have sold it, you know, for $100,000. Who knew? Then, of course, Eric's got stolen, and that, you know, I finally agreed to sell him mine because I was becoming a Telecaster man rather than a Les Paul guy. And he recorded Fresh Cream with it. But it's a very historical moment, obviously, because what if he hadn't gotten my Les Paul?
He might have been using tellies.
He might have gone back to the telly.
Yeah, I want to use your telly, Andy.
The Les Paul could have not become the star that it has, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting little moment there.
That's a great one. Mm-hmm. And you said in the book that you were you walk into the room and like White Room or one of the tracks from Heavy Cream. No, I'm so glad
it
was on, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
That's playing, and but the guitars back then were like 100 pounds, so it's nothing like it is today.
Yeah, I think we paid. I think I paid £80 for that Telecaster. I mean that Les Paul, and then eventually, however many months later, sold it to Eric for 200.
Double,
which was
doubled your money, man.
Top dollar, and you know his manager didn't want to pay me that for it.
He was a bit of a tough guy.
But already something was happening.
Right.
Probably because Eric had been playing it.
Now, your early forays into music, heavy into jazz, and I like the fact that you were into the American guitarists like Wes Montgomery and Grant Green and cats like that.
Yeah.
What was it that made you really latch on to their genre, their vibe?
Yeah, I don't know, because I mean, probably like, you know, at 14 or 15, I could already play all the sort of surf melodies, and I'd learned a number of chords and stuff. I think one of the key things actually sort of really got me into it was there was this program, which I mentioned in the book actually, called Guitar Club on Saturday nights every week in England. And I started listening to this, and of course most of these guitar players were really jazz guitar wannabes, and I'd sort of hear this more complex playing, but kind of thought, I gotta get a bit, how do they do that, you know? And that's, I think my brain went there. I didn't go, oh, that's too complicated, I never want to play like that. I was pulled towards it, you know. Also, I think, you know, the thing I like to point out in the book is that, you know, this period in England, you know, we had really crappy pop music, very puerile stuff, and then we had this kind of, we were aware of this jazz music coming from America, and the real rebellion and the real cats wearing dark glasses and everything and all the rest and sort of living on the edge with the jazz players.
All the heavy bebop guys.
Yeah, so in terms of like being hip and cool and like going to the edge and being where it was really at, it was with jazz because it certainly wasn't with rock at that point,
right.
Not in England. I mean, maybe you could have, you know, obviously found people in the States like Elvis and, you know, I don't know, Link Graham, people like that, but we weren't really so aware of that. What we had was this very puerile pop music in England. So the ideal was to be a jazz man.
But you were also into the whole literary boom that was happening in those days, too.
Yeah,
you
I know, mean, I was reading
the
all
Beats
the...
Beats in San Francisco.
Yes, absolutely. I was reading a lot of Kerouac and trying to, like, you know, I don't know how much I understood at the time, but I was certainly picking up on a lot of American stuff, you know, stuff that was already emanating from the 50s, you know, with the Beats and Ginsberg, Kerouac, and Gregory Corso, Burroughs, and so on and so forth. And this was the cutting edge. And, of course, that's what I was interested in, and the music they listened to was bebop.
So there's no question that influenced your latter-day style when you started migrating more into the pop and the punk world.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, I think, you know, you're really sort of formed in your teens, and I think between about 15 and 20, I was just a total jazz nut, and, you know, this is what I was trying to play all the time with whatever information I could get. But it really stays with you for the rest of your life because that's the period when I really kind of, you know, found the way I phrase on the guitar, you know, my kind of phrasing, the sort of lyrical way I play. It really comes from that period. Of course, you grow, you learn more, and you add a lot more as you go on through life, you know, playing the instrument. But I think that's always been the absolute bedrock of my playing. It came from that period.
Right. And you know, I just noticed in your playing technique, even when I was listening to the Police records, and some of them I hadn't gone to for a couple of years, is your approach into the pop structure. And the way you played a chord, it wasn't just a, you know, your standard bar chord. There was always a shading to it or something,
right.
You know, an 11th or, you know.
Yeah, well, this is true. I mean, one of the things I think that distinguished the Police was, well, excuse me, certainly the guitar playing. Like, but it was, you know, let's just put it this way. The way I accompanied the vocals had been different than most people had before. And these huge bar chords that, you know, were very prevalent and heavier, you know, rock, pop. Always sounded too much to me, and of course the question goes deeper because I was in this crucible, you know, playing with Sting and Stewart, that I was able to start bringing this up. Sting had very not big ears but big harmonic hearing, so when I would play these pieces behind him and start to extend the chords and add what I thought were more interesting notes, see that? He went with it, you know. He didn't go, "Oh, that's too weird, you know, don't play
right.
that." You know, he could hear it, and you know, because he'd already, you know, spent years listening to Miles and Monk, just as I had. So we had this in common, and didn't throw him. But we were playing rock, and we had this fantastic drummer driving us along.
Oh yeah.
So these sort of disparate elements actually came together to form a more interesting rock music.
Well, the point where you started going more psychedelic in your career seemed to be, within reading the book, when you really started exploring, even going farther out with your chords and your patterns, your chord patterns.
Yeah, well, it's like that's a very good point. I started off sort of listening to the, you know, like Wes Montgomery and Barney Kessel and Jimmy Rainey. They were really coming out of the sort of bebop period. But as I went on, and even as jazz itself developed in that sort of 60s period, when everything started to open up musically, all things started to open up. Became a time of very free expression. You see the same thing in painting, theater, cinema. I started listening to, you know, Middle Eastern music and Indian music and African music, and I'd hear guitarists like Gabor Szabo, you know, starting to really take it out. And, you know, that started to appeal to me. So now we were going beyond standard chord structures and the stuff that had dominated through the 40s and the 50s, which was really based on standards that were written for, like, show tunes, you know, standard verse, chorus, verse, 32-bar structures. Suddenly, it was opening up, and then we were getting Miles creating modal music, and, you know, I was paying attention to all this, and so I started to open up my guitar playing too, to go along with it.
Right.
So I was absorbing it all. And within the context I was playing, I always tried to add it in if I could. And then I went from what was basically a sort of a, you know, not straight ahead, I don't know if it's the right, but a real sort of a copy R&B band where we played James Brown and Otis Redding and Rufus Thomas and all that, which had been very good training in a way, to a psychedelic acid rock band where, you know, now we were going to be very expressive. We started to play modal music, and I'd play very, very long guitar solos over one chord, you know, and it was all very expressive and spiritual, and that's what we were doing, you know. But it, that came in the mid to late 60s. We started to find that we could start to do this now. It wasn't just the nifty little 16-bar solo in the middle of a pop song, which was like a release. It was further expression, man.
Just take it out. Just, who are some of the guys that you were latching onto? Because obviously Clapton had his whole group and disciple, the heavy blues rock, and Peter Green and all those guys. Were there any guys, you know, in America? I mean, did you see Hendrix when he first hit London and everyone was clamoring?
I did. Absolutely.
You know, and you're like, wow, okay, he's taking blues even farther out and using effects pedals and, and all this stuff. But were there any guys, like, were you into John Fahey and guys that were using alternate tunings, Bert Jansch? You know?
Yes, I did have something of an ear from that. John Fahey in particular, who actually I've been listening to again recently.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's timeless, just...
John Fahey is a one-off. He's sort of like, you know, I think he ended up calling his music American Primitive.
Right.
To me, he sort of occupied, you know, in terms of that sort of acoustic guitar playing, a lot of which I have to say is very drippy and not very interesting to me. It's not very good music, a lot of it. John Fahey actually still sits there like a rock to me. I put on John Fahey, and I'm actually finding it very interesting. And what it is he's got a very quirky sensibility. Mm-hmm. He's sort of like the Thelonious Monk of that acoustic guitar.
The way he
style.
Hits the notes and the attack.
He's a very solid player, and he has an interesting. He goes off. He plays weird harmonies that shouldn't be there. He's not a straight ahead, straight down the line lyrical player. He's a very quirky player, but he's a strong player.
Right.
And I know he was a very kind of brilliant guy. He started off working in a gas station, apparently, when he was 20. And then he ended up going to some university and getting a PhD in philosophy. And he would rant on stage for hours. And he wrote a book. But you see, there was a real mindset there that he followed through all the way through until the end of his death. But he's one in particular. I was actually listening to at that period, too. And I did listen to Bert Jansch. John Rambert, I remember their recording very early in the mid-60s, I think they did an acoustic duo of Goodbye Pork Pie Hat.
Right.
This was all the stuff that was very interesting to me.
Right.
Some of the alternate tuning stuff.
I was
going to
ask you the open D's and the...
Yeah, I'm very into it now. I mean, it's not really... I've always been very snobby about it. I always said, after playing alternate tunings, you don't really understand the... You know, you don't know any chords, you know. So I always was, you know, a totally harmonic player that had spent my life relentlessly pursuing, you know, harmonic information on the guitar with standard tuning. In other words, more and more and more and more chords, you know, more kind of inversions, ways of playing.
Right.
All these advanced chords like piano players. But in the last couple of years, I have actually gotten into alternate tunings. The one everyone loves, of course, is what they call DADGAD, you know, D-A-D.
I learned it from listening to John Martin records.
Yeah, well, that's an incredible tuning.
And Roy
tuning.
Harper as well.
Right, and that tuning, I believe, came to light with a great guitarist called David Graham, who was on that scene in London at that point, but was really kind of led the way. And most guys who are into this scene, everyone's older now, would great David Graham.
Right.
He'd already been to you know, Morocco and done all this stuff. And he came back, I believe, from Morocco with this, you know, DADGAD tuning that, of course, has become so standard in the acoustic guitar world. He was the first one doing it.
I didn't know that. That's a good piece. It's a good piece of history for the kids to know, man.
Maybe your kids out there,
dig a little deeper, man. You know, you find these records.
I also like the D minor tuning, by the way.
Right.
Tape out of the fifth fret. That gets pretty weird.
You know Charlie Hunter? Have you seen him play yet? Because he's playing the 7 and 8 string guitar in these open tunings. He's playing the bass lines with the sixth and seventh string simultaneous to playing, and he's playing chords on and these really weird. I asked him, you know, is this like a D variation? He's like, don't even go there. His tunings are so out, and his playing is so out. But he's playing T Monk style stuff. He actually had a band called T.J. Kirk, which was T for Thelonious Monk, J for James Brown, and then
Roland Kirk.
Brilliant. So they're playing just cover songs, but within the context, three guitar players and a drummer. So he's playing the bass parts, and they're all just ripping.
Yeah.
I think you'll dig him.
He's
like of the young guys I've seen out there. You know, he's mid-30s or something. Right. He is just
he's doing it.
Yeah. But it must be frustrating for you, who, you know, coming from that, like you said earlier, you know, where's the new music? Where's the inspiration? I like Radiohead. There are a handful of bands that might weather a 10-year career stretch, have something to add 10 years down the road. Certainly not the same way it was when...
No, I mean...
It can't be. Classical music and jazz had the same thing, Renaissance periods. And,
You know. Yes, it's fairly diabolical right now. I mean, some guy just prior to coming here asked me, "Oh, what are you listening to? You know, what do you think?" I said,
John Fahey, man.
A lot of guitar, rock bands, but I don't know. I listen to everything. Sounds so much of a retread to me. It's hard. I mean, there's so much out there. It's like, how can I listen to every rock band? It's not that interesting to me. I you know, really come from a period where I thought it was so much more interesting. And I tend to, you know, not that you want to kind of put yourself, you know, you keep very open. Okay, there's something great. I'm perfectly open to listening to it. But particularly in the rock scene, that's like, I mean, there are endless sort of Joni Mitchell, you know, clones out there, singer-songwriters. It's like, I don't hear anything that's better than what I sort of grew up with. You know, yeah, Radiohead, okay. But, I mean, they're probably at base, they're a good rock band, you know. But, you know, and they've had they've tried, you know.
Yeah, they're trying to push the envelope.
To push the envelope. And I really appreciate what they're doing. But you know, there's nothing there that they're doing musically that's new for me.
Right.
I have to say, honestly.
Sure.
They're a nice sounding band. The guy's voice is nice.
Push comes to shove. Who would you say you would hail as a guitar hero for you?
Guitar hero?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Ralph Towner.
Great.
He's my favorite.
Right. ECM, all those old ECM records. I wish they'd re-release those records, man.
Talk about. I was a major ECM fan, particularly
Terry Riple and.
Yeah, I always loved ECM. They don't seem to put out as much as they used to.
Right.
But that was like the last great flowering of jazz, I thought, as far as it goes. That was the last sort of school, you know, that kind of cool ECM sound.
Yeah.
And that was really the 70s. You know, of course, it's continued, but. Unfortunately, jazz, as far as it goes, I hate to say it, is sort of become a museum art. I don't really hear anything very new all the time, you know.
Are you hip to Matthew Shipp? Do you know his piano playing?
No, I don't know.
He's a guy, lives in New York, he's done 26 albums, and he's basically said, I'm going to stop recording because there's no audience for it. And as genius as he is, and he's like the lyrical quality of Keith Jarrett meets kind of Ahmad Jamal's Attack. You know, he's a guy our age, my age rather, and he's like, you know, where's my audience? You know,
it's tough.
Europe and maybe the Far East.
Yeah, it's gotten very, very difficult.
But he plays in New York to like, you know, a handful of people, and it's a shame.
Yeah, it's wicked. I know.
Yeah. It's really, really tough. All right, in blues, Peter Green or Eric Clapton?
Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
Long shot.
Okay. How about in this kind of the speed, the fusion world, McLaughlin, DiMeola, Mike Stern, any of those guys?
I don't dig any of that.
No? Okay.
I think John McLaughlin is a great musician. I find it very difficult always to get off on his playing. I just don't like the way he phrases.
Right.
I mean, I'm only going to say not very nice. You might not want to put this in there. I'm not a huge fan. Jazz fusion, it's so kind of generic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot of time for it. You know,
right.
And there are some very facile guitar players.
Sure.
But, you know, like, for instance, jazz fusion, there's a certain, I'd think of it as 70s music.
Right.
I mean, but it's Bill Frisell, jazz fusion. What is that?
I don't know. Frisell is so textured. He's more in the ECM school, you know.
In a way, he is.
Yeah.
See, Mark Rebo is a great player. Interesting player.
Right.
I do really like and I admire Mark Rebo. He put on a concert I saw in LA. It was one of the best concerts I ever saw in my life.
Right.
Brilliant.
Was he doing the Cuban music?
Yes,
yeah.
He was. And he played on a 12-string guitar. Man, it was mad.
Yeah.
I got a lot of time for him. Yeah, obviously... Schofield.
Yes, you know, John Schofield,
one of
sure.
All-time greatest improvisers of all time. I like John Abercrombie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a few people that, you know, whose records I would consistently listen to, although even with those guys, it's like, okay, I got it, you know.
You got it, and it's like, you don't want to overdose on it.
How much, you know, the thing is, like, how much, just like this guy was asking me earlier today, how much can you listen to? I only have so much space in my head, and I like to think about my own music, my own compositions. my own plane. I don't want to jam my head with other people's stuff all the time.
Sure.
You know, I mean, when I was younger, I did, but I've got an awful lot of music in my head. I don't want to be listening to the latest guy all the time. I'm just not interested in it, you know.
Right.
You stay current, you know, you hear what's going on, but, you know, I think that's for other people. Musicians have a different take about music and, you know, sonic space. I don't know, I like silence.
It's a good thing.
It's nice here, actually.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? There's nobody around. The artists aren't painting. They'll start migrating.
It's because it's like, you know, you develop this thing in your head. It's like becoming a wine connoisseur. You know, you're not going to drink Coca-Cola all your life. Your taste just naturally refines. Same thing with music.
Right.
You know, if I'm somewhere and there's some crappy music playing, it just, I have to get away from it.
You can't wait to get out.
I can't stay.
Yeah, I quite agree. The whole world of jazz, I want to ask you another question because an Italian journalist friend proposed this to me. He says, you know, the piano and the guitar don't go together in jazz. And I thought that's a very interesting point because I was thinking back, like, have I heard any music where it actually worked? Kind of in Miles's thing, but everyone had a different role in the Miles Davis world. But I was stumped. I don't know.
Well, it's a cliche. I mean, and I've heard this since I was a teenager, because the guitar and the piano occupy the same harmonic space.
Right.
So you can't both be going, you know, comping away.
Right.
You just really get in one another's way. But there are instances where it has worked. For instance, two beautiful jazz albums were made by Jim Hall and Bill Evans.
Right, sure.
Undercurrent and... what's the other one? Undercurrent and...
my friend Christian would know.
Yeah, there's one. Yeah. Undercurrent's one of them anyway.
I'll email you later with the other one.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm going to go nuts trying to think about it. But they made two very beautiful records together. But it mostly was with Jim Hall not playing chords, but playing these, you know, soft melodic lines along with Bill Evans. I mean, for instance, I usually play in a trio with guitar, you know, bass and drums. I like to occupy all the space. If the keyboard was in there...
unless it's an organ and it's padding.
Yeah, sometimes synths or organ, you can make it work more. I think more in a rock band context that would work. It's difficult.
I mean, you know, the great Jimmy Smith, Wes Montgomery record, you know, where they were really digging in and doing that.
Yeah, you know, that kind of works, yeah.
Yeah, it's more of a funk jazz kind of thing.
Yeah,
but,
what's
your favorite Police story? From a gig or recording or something.
Can you hand me that book? I'm going to have to look it up. You know? Well, yes, we got that.
All right.
Piece of metal sitting on top of my beautiful book.
Can you be displaying
this for all to see.
Exactly. And tell them the story about what the title is, which is a great story.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of reasons for calling it that. You know, it's a metaphor, you know, obviously. And although, in actual fact, there's an incident in the book where... let's see, what page is that on? Oh, it's right here.
Morris. Come on.
Opened it at the bloody page.
Did you really? Oh, synchronicity.
Uh-oh. How about that? Uh-oh. Let's see, I'll tell you what page it's on. No, it's a bit earlier. Anyway, I just talk about how I'd sort of done my initial stint with Stuart and Sting, and it was basically over. We did the one gig we were supposed to do together, but I was there, a presence. One morning I speak to Sting on the phone, and we sort of had this long talk about, well, you know, really should be in the band. You have this other guitarist, it's a problem.
Right.
You can't do it. And then about an hour later, I got on a train and went into the West End of London, and one of those weird coincidences that Stuart got off the train with me, and he sort of laughed. Nice to see you again. But then we did sit down and had this long chat about, you know, whether I should or should not be in the band. But anyway, the point of one train later was that I sort of digressed philosophically as I tell this part of the story, how... one train later, and I hadn't gotten that train, maybe we'd never had this conversation. Sting would have gone back to Newcastle.
Right.
Stuart would have joined the Peace Corps.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. There would have been no Police.
No history.
Know? So who knows?
Right.
I also use it as a slight metaphor for my sort of arriving at this important stage somewhat later than I meant to.
Yes, you had another career before that.
Yeah.
But you were able to sustain, and that in itself is saying a hell of a lot for any musician.
I think it was holding me there.
Yeah, you know, typically, unless you're the band leader or the songwriter, you know, it's difficult. And then the rebirth after the Police of yourself yet again. And your first solo record's a duo with Fripp.
Mm-hmm.
So you started out getting replaced by him, and then you guys are you're doing your first solo piece with him.
Yes, he's definitely played a part in my life, no question about it, you know. Well, we came from the same town, you know, certainly had awareness of each other as sort of rival guitarists in Bournemouth, England, which is southwest of England in Dorset. Yeah, then he took over my crappy little hotel gig as I went off to London. Then, of course, he went to London a few years later and started King Crimson, became incredibly successful.
Yeah.
But he helped me along the way. And then eventually, you know, we just kept sort of passing each other and ending up, we ended up making a couple of albums together.
Right.
Which were great fun.
We need to get those back into print. We got to get a label out there to...
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd like to see it. Well, I think they're probably still owned by A&M, but I've thought about that myself. I think there would be a market for those now.
Completely now. I mean, Proc seems to be making a little bit of a renaissance.
Yeah.
You know, there's the rumbling of Pink Floyd finally, you know, going out on that mega tour and everyone, you know.
Yeah, they need the money. They need to get out there and do that. Yeah.
You know, we're playing those expensive golf courses, you know. Those green fees, man, they can add up.
Yeah, Roger Waters was just in L.A. this weekend, the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, he was?
Sold out both nights.
Yeah.
You know, he did all right.
Well, there you go. Well, and it also brings back the point we talk about the music. I mean, you're not going to go out and fill stadiums with the music that's happening. It's very difficult. You know, it's very difficult. There's no catalog. There's no interesting. I mean, there is to an extent, but to really, I think, inspire those that have the money to pay the big bucks for the tickets.
Yeah.
Unless it's just nostalgia, and then we're all just kidding ourselves.
Are you talking about a Police reunion?
Yeah.
I think we sell out every stadium in the
world.
No,
I think you would, yeah. I think it would be fantastic. Have there been any rumblings of...
There's always rumblings. Yeah. It's like a sort of ongoing tremor.
And right.
Really sort of...
But is it the thought of the road and just all of that?
Oh, no, it's something to do with me. Nothing to do with me whatsoever. No.
Scooped here first.
It's purely, I mean, you know, and I say this with great kindness and, you know, it's Sting's decision. You know, he's got to do it when he feels ready to do it.
Right.
If he wants to do it, you know. I don't think about it very much. I know it's always going on, and most interviews talk about it. It's just like, yeah, okay, so it's a permanent feature now. When is it going to happen, you know? So I don't think about it too much because it's too crazy to think about it. Of course, it would be fun and it would be, I suppose, a huge financial reward and a lot of people would be very happy. But I can't, it's torturous to think about things like that.
Sure.
I just, you know, I'm thinking about this book, you know, okay, what am I going to do next year? You know, what record's coming next? I'm occupied with my own stuff.
Right.
If that happens, then okay, you know, off we go.
What was your favorite song to play when you were on stage with the Police?
There's always Message in a Bottle.
Really?
Yeah, it was just such a joy to play that. It was just such a stunning piece. I always thought it was the best single track we ever made. You know, most of it was fun, but that one was always a standout.
Right, yeah. There's so many. I mean, again, I think as a music freak, you get so inundated with new music, you forget what you liked in your youth. And I went back and I actually bought some of the Police records the other day and I was listening to it and I'm like, God, you know, there's a lot of the... non-single tracks that I forgot were really stellar. And, you know, the first couple of records with the whole reggae thing, how did that happen, that style? How did you migrate into that?
Well, you know, I mean, being English, you know, of course, there's a Jamaican community that's always been, certainly in London, so I was very aware of it. And, you know, probably in my own, you know, life since I was, you know, 12, 13, passed through... ska, you know, Blue Beat, ska, and then, was there anything else? There was another one, I think, and then eventually...
When was dance hall? It was ska, Blue Beat, and then there was a style right in between, because you had Desmond Decker doing Israelites. Is that more ska, or is that more...
I think that's ska, and then, you know, eventually they called it reggae. But yeah, I was very aware of the whole, you know, Jamaican music thing. And the way it really actually came about, in our case, was... whichever point, I think it was 76 into 77, was it? Or was it 77 into 78? Maybe that was it.
Marley had already really happened, and he happened
was
first.
Happening, yeah. But we had a very lonely Christmas with absolutely no prospects whatsoever, and Sting was going to have a party or something, and Stuart loaned him his Bob Marley records. Sting, you know, played all these records, really kind of got into it, and he picked up on the bass line thing, you know, this open bass line. And that was where the seed was sown, I think, because he started to turn up with these songs that were kind of a little bit influenced by that.
Right.
And, of course, it was a convenience for him because, you know, he was singing and he didn't have to, like, keep up this relentless, you know, thing. all the time. It gave him space to sing and to play the lines, which he did very well. He has incredible independence between his voice and his bass playing. Very difficult thing.
Very difficult. People don't realize that. And then do it in a simple pattern, even more so.
Yeah, it's a difficult trick.
Yeah.
He does it.
And, but then the whole thing, so you already were copying those licks anyway. You already knew a lot of them. And
well, I mean...
And the Scott thing was just now starting to hit with the English beat and the specials.
Yeah, people were starting to really pick up on it around about that point. And it was, oddly enough, in the sort of almost religious mindset of the punk movement, you could only be this, you can't be that, you can't be that, you can't be that, you know, otherwise you're failed.
Right.
For some reason, they were okay with Jamaican music. They liked it. They liked reggae.
Yeah, the Clash championed it early on, too.
Yeah, so that was acceptable.
And you guys just took it to the pop charts, big.
There you go.
Yeah, very, very big. You know, I saw one of your early tours, and I must say I went to see the opening act, XTC. Do you remember that tour with XTC? Their only tour because of the stage fright issues with Andy.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, yeah.
Yeah, and I was living in Cleveland, Ohio, and it was a pretty wild show. See you, two huge bands, you know, just in the beginning of your careers and conquering America on the same stage.
Cleveland
Agora.
Book sold out in Cleveland already.
There you go.
Someone called me and told me that.
WMMS was a huge, I think, it was one of those radio stations that broke a lot of English bands. Early on when T-Rex was happening and Mott the Hoople, and then the pub rock bands, and then when alternative and new wave and punk started happening again.
Mm-hmm.
Any given night you could see bands coming into Cleveland.
Oh, we played there. Was it the Pirate's Cove?
That was another place, the Pirate's Cove.
Did you read the story in here?
No, I missed that one. Tell me, I didn't...
About Raven Slaughter?
No, you have to share, please.
Oh, well, no, I talk about this band in, I think...
The Pirate's Cove, sure.
Yeah, we turned up. Should read from the book, really.
Why don't you read something from the book?
Let me read it from the book, because it's a funny... Well, and it has a payoff. Let's see...
The Pirate... I haven't even thought of that, Andy, since you... I haven't thought of the Pirate's Cove. I spent many a... drunken college night in the Pirate's Cove.
Anywhere. Let's see, they put Ravenswood.
The Dead Boys, Devo. Yeah. We used to see Devo play.
Yeah, well, Jerry's a very close friend of mine.
Oh, yeah, you guys are in L.A. together.
Yeah, we've been friends.
Jerry is Jihad. What's the name of his new band, the Jihad?
Jerry. No, it's Jerry Jihad and the Evil Doers.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Here we go.
This is the... Okay, so... we drive out to the Midwest and into Cleveland, where we have a show at the Pirate's Cove. It's late October, and we pull up to the stage door in gloom and cold. Inside, the crepuscular ambience of the club is suffused with a faint smell of beer and cigarettes, the vestige of loneliness accented by the garish posters on the wall. There is a small stage at one end where we will try to take it to the people. Just as we are setting up, four or five guys who look like roadies march in and ask us, what the fuck do we think we are doing? And who the fuck are we? We let them know, the fucking support group. They grunt at one another and tell us that they are to set up for Raven Slaughter, the local headliner. I need to set up first. Okay, whatever, we say. Letting them have their little power play and take off up to the dressing room where we piss ourselves with laughter. Raven Slaughter? Christ, in this day and age... The group themselves eventually turn up and are not disappointed, and we're not disappointed. In black leather, biblical hair, eyeliner, and metal studs, they look like fugitives from a Dracula film. They give us the cold shoulder. We are nothing. They are Raven Slaughter. And we try to keep a straight face, but it's difficult. The lead guitarist is called Killer, and he keeps swigging straight from a bottle of tequila. In our tiny corner of the dressing room, we quietly make remarks like, hard, ever so hard. And continue reading our paperbacks. After the shows there, having brilliantly fulfilled all our expectations with songs about the coming darkness, Satan, werewolves, and such, we watch gently as poor old Killer heaves his guts out at the side of the dressing room, a night's work complete.
There it is, man. Cleveland rocks, Cleveland's finest. Anyway. Well, that's, you know, the joke
it
was...
It has a kind ending, that story, because it sounds a bit mean, but... Hang on, let me just show you something else here.
Okay.
Just because this is where it really ends. Yeah, this is much further along. Toward the end of the tour, we play in Cleveland again. We are interviewed on local TV before we get to the hotel. We mention having been in Cleveland before and our good mates, Ravenslaughter. Good eggs, those boys. And then go on to the local legendary rock and roll hotel, Swingo's. When we get there, Ravenslaughter are all waiting in the lobby for us and want to have a drink, go to the bar, chat about old times. They saw our interview and are very grateful for the mention. So we have drinks.
There you go. There you go. Cleveland rocks, you know. All the great bands had to leave, unfortunately, but, you know.
MC5? Oh, Detroit.
Detroit. Now, we had the Dead Boys, and we had Pere Ubu, and we had Tin Huey and the Waitresses. And
must be something about that area brings it out.
Yeah. What's the bleakness of working in a tire mill or a steel mill? And that's about it. It's like being...
That'll do it to you. Yeah. That'll produce the rock music.
It'll get it going. What's the most difficult song you've ever attempted to play when you were learning to play, or maybe even today? I mean, maybe you're writing.
When you say song, do you mean song or do you mean piece of music?
Piece of music. Yeah,
all right. Well, probably the most. I've done several. I mean, we get into a different area here. I mean, I played a piece of music at Carnegie Hall last year called "Dark Fluorescence," which was a piece written for a classical guitar and electric guitar, and symphony orchestra based on all these Balinese scales. That was difficult.
Mm.
Maybe the most difficult thing I've ever done, just because the situation is difficult. I had to, you know, have all this music out, and I'm watching the conductor, watching the other guitarist, making sure my gear does not break down live at Carnegie Hall.
Sure.
Sweating bullets. That's tough.
Yeah.
I think the most difficult stuff I've done has usually been in those contexts where I've played with orchestras or something. Not necessarily because it's classical music, but it's just so full of tension.
And the precision of each player and everyone's counting on each other, being right there.
Yeah. It's not necessarily my favorite thing to do. I've done it a few times. I like to be freer, you know, really in a dialogue with the drummer. That's where I like to really take off, you know. Those situations are interesting for the challenge of the, you know, what you have to get through, but they're not necessarily the most fun.
Right. I'm wondering if we can get you to play something instrumentally.
Ew.
No?
Actually pick up a guitar.
Yeah, come on.
Well, like what?
This is a nice one. Anything you want to. It could be something old, something new, something you're just fooling around on. Put it in another tuning if you'd like. I've got a drop D on the top, on the bottom string. It's actually quite a nice guitar. I'm thinking of buying it, actually. That sounds quite good, doesn't it?
Right.
It's a 175. I don't know if this...
175?
Yeah, see, the 200s, I think, the bodies are too big.
Oh, J175.
Yeah, and the J45...
185.
Or 185, I stand correct.
Sorry,
Gibson.
Classical guitar.
I'd like to hear a whole album of acoustic Andy Summers. That's beautiful. That's got a nice even tone, doesn't it?
It's a nice guitar.
Yeah.
Plays well. Mm-hmm.
Bravo. I love that. Thank you.
Yeah.
What do you call that piece?
I don't know. Just improvising. You're
just improvising. There you go.
The first one is Lamento by Jobim.
Right. Have you done a whole record acoustic? Just the acoustic guitar and no embellishments? Have you thought of it?
Yeah, that's the next record I want to put out, actually. It's going to be a nylon string, but it's all solo. I've got about half of it ready to go. Yeah. The next record I'm going to put out is going to be this record I did with Ben Verdery. He's a great classical guitarist from New York. We made a really interesting record over the last year when we were involved in doing Carnegie Hall.
Right.
Him playing, it was incredible. You know, right hand, you know, amazing sort of and technique he has for, you know, playing fast arpeggios and all the rest of it. And he also does interesting things with a lot of alternate tunings. And I played a lot of electric guitar. That's a really nice record.
Right.
With an amazing version of Bring On The Night on it. That's going to come out probably in January. But that next one I was going to be solo guitar.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. How about some shows in the area? You got any shows planned?
Don't know. I mean, I didn't play so much this year because I was sort of getting involved in film projects, and then I've missed it. I only did two gigs this year so far. I did one in California, and last weekend I played a big concert in Costa Rica, which was really wonderful. Then I've got the book, so it's going to be next year. But
yeah, on the big.
Yeah, thinking about it. Where I'm going to go and play and do. Yeah, New York's always great for me. I've played here many, many, many times. Birdland many times.
Great.
So, yeah.
Well, there you go. Anything else you want to add to?
Buy the book, please. Thank you.
Andy, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Great.
Thanks.
Could only get unconscious if I'd had too much to drink. There was somehow something wrong somewhere, and each day seemed grey and dead. The seeds of desperation were growing in me head. I needed inspiration, a brand new start in life, somewhere to place affection, but I didn't want a wife. And then by lucky chance I saw in a special magazine an ad that was unusual, the like I'd never seen. Experience something different with our new imported toy. She's loving, warm, inflatable, and a guarantee of joy. She came all wrapped in cardboard, all pink and shriveled down. A breath of air was all she needed to make her lose that frown. I took her to the bedroom and pumped her with some life. And later, in a moment, that girl became my wife. And so I sit her in the corner and sometimes stroke her hair. And when I'm feeling naughty, I blow her up with air. She's cuddly and she's bouncy. She's like a rubber ball. I bounce her in the kitchen and I bounce her in the hall. And now my life is different since Sally came my way. I wake up in the morning and have her on a tray. She's everything they said she was, and I wear a permanent grin. And I only have to worry in case my girl wears thin.
Would you be my girl? Would you be my girl? Would you be my girl?
I'd like to thank our friends from Samson Tech for providing the Zoom H4, a handy palm-sized digital recorder, perfect for your podcasting needs. And don't forget to stay tuned for the Andy Summers video podcast. We'll be posting that on our site, culturecatch.com, in the next few weeks. And much, much more to follow. So keep it here, keep it real. Converge is the word. Culture.